Read Japanese Literature is supporting earthquake recovery efforts in Wajima, Japan, especially among artisans working in its traditional Japanese urushi industry. You can find out how to help the Matsuzawa Urushi Workshop's Phoenix Project at tinyurl.com/urushirecovery, URUSHI recovery, and I'll explain more about the project at the end of the episode. This is Read Japanese Literature. My name is Allison Fincher. Read Japanese Literature is a podcast about Japanese fiction and some of its best works. All the works we discuss are available in translation, so you can read along if you want. You can find out more at readjapaneseliterature.com. Happy Valentine's Day, or at least Valentine's Week. It turns out that I prepared way too much content to get recorded and edited in time for a February 14th release. But today, Read Japanese Literature is taking a look at misogyny in Japanese literature alongside the life and work of Yukio Mishima. To deal with all that extra content, we've actually broken our story into two episodes for your listening convenience, but they are definitely intended as a set. Part one begins with a little bit of context about the history of attitudes about women in Japanese culture. I'll say now, and I'll say again, that misogyny is not a problem exclusive to Japan. We'll move on to the way those attitudes about women have played into modern Japanese literature, including the work of some of Japan's most celebrated authors. In part two, we'll take a look at Yukio Mishima. We'll include content from Confessions of a Mask. Confessions of a Mask is an I novel, a sort of pseudo-biographical account of Mishima's life. We'll pull biographical details and examples of misogyny from many of his other novels. And I'll offer up some of my own theories about Mishima and gender, for whatever they're worth. A few quick content warnings for both episodes. This episode will, obviously, include a lot of examples of misogyny, and there will be two references to rape in two different novels. The rest of the content warnings apply mostly to part two. There will be references to internalized homophobia. Yukio Mishima's sincerely held beliefs are a little hard to puzzle out, as we'll discuss, but the man said some fascist things, and it is never my intention to promote fascism. Mishima's political beliefs aren't really a part of our discussion today anyway. Finally, Yukio Mishima's life story ends with his suicide. You won't be able to easily jump around any of these issues. If they are a problem, it's probably better to skip part two. Patreon content this time includes a lot more about the role of women in Japanese history and some more biography from Mishima's life. Of course, the main reason to join Patreon is to support the podcast. For this episode, Patreon supporters helped purchase an important biography of Mishima that really helped prepare. Thank you. It isn't too late to sign up. patreon.com/readjapaneseliterature. Before we begin, I'd like to clarify, again, that I am not throwing stones from a glass house. I'm an American. This hasn't been a good decade for women's rights. I know there is a lot of misogyny in European and American cultures, as well as in European and American literatures. And we Americans have our geniuses whose work is full of misogyny too. Our Ernest Hemingways, our Henry Millers, our John Updikes. But I'm focusing on misogyny in Japan and Japanese literature here today for a couple of reasons. Number one, we're a podcast about Japanese literature. And number two, Misogyny in Japanese literature shapes the way we non-Japanese think about Japanese women, Japanese men, the relationships between men and women in Japan. We, as readers of literature in translation, need to be aware of the way misogynistic writers' stories both shape and distort the real picture in Japan. And we need to be aware that we, as readers in translation, are only getting the works in translation that publishers are presenting to us, the ones that publishers have a reasonable expectation will sell. Specifically, Osamu Dazai and Yukio Mishima are literary geniuses that I, for one, am very grateful to have access to. But if they're the only mid-century Japanese writers we have access to, we aren't getting anything like a full picture, and we're going to end up with a very sexist account. So, let's start with a definition. What is misogyny? There are a lot of feminist scholars with precise philosophical definitions of misogyny couched in theoretical language. Their work is absolutely valuable. But today, I'm using misogyny in its historical and most literal sense. Misogyny comes to us all the way from ancient Greek, almost unchanged, and means literally hatred of or hatred towards women. Sexism is the way people act in a culture that devalues people based on their gender. A sexist action can be intentionally misogynist, or a sort of learned behavior in a misogynist culture. For our purposes today, I'm going to begin our tale in the Edo period, that's 1603 to 1868. We like to tell ourselves a linear story about misogyny, a story that kind of goes in a straight, slowly upward line. Men used to hate women the most. Over the last 4,000 years, they've hated women slowly, less and less. If we keep doing things the way we are, someday we will all be equal. Ta-da! But the Edo period was really one of the lowest, if not the lowest point for women's rights in Japan. Just like it wasn't a great period for women's rights in Europe or later America either. In both Japan and Europe, women saw rights disappear and attitudes become even worse between 1600 or so and the late 1800s. For example, Spanish diplomats to the Tudor court in England wrote home in the 1530s and 40s complaining about how free English women were. Imagine what they would have had to say about the women of Jane Austen's day in the early 1800s. Or the women of Charles Dickens's day during the Victorian period. For many centuries, the rules that defined a well-to-do woman's life in the Edo period were summed up in a text inspired by Chinese Neo-Confucianism called The Great Learning for Women. The oldest surviving copy dates to 1729, but it is generally assumed that a Neo-Confucian scholar named Kaibara Ekiken, wrote The Great Learning for Women in the 1670s. The Great Learning for Women is full of tidbits like this. The five worst infirmities that afflict women are indocility, discontent, slander, jealousy, and silliness. Without a doubt, these infirmities are found in 7 or 8 of every 10 women, and it is they that cause women to be inferior to men. The worst of them all and the parent of the other 4 is silliness. Such is the stupidity of a woman's character that it is incumbent on her in every detail to distrust herself and obey her husband. This 19-chapter book was a common wedding gift to new brides. The Great Learning for Women had a huge cultural impact. But I should note that it doesn't represent the only attitude about women during the Edo period. It also doesn't represent the only attitude about women held by Neo-Confucianists or even in Ekiken's writings. But these same sorts of ideas were often summarized as the three obedience Edo-era Japanese women were supposed to follow. A woman should be obedient first as an obedient daughter to her father, then as a chaste wife to her husband, and then as a widow dedicated to her family, she should obey her son. After the Meiji Restoration in 1868, an increasing number of women rebelled against those three obediences and the misogyny represented in the Great Learning for Women. There were many men, too, who thought the three obediences were out of date. Over the next several decades, a new role for women emerged, that of good wife and wise mother, or in Japanese, ryōsai kenbō. An educated woman would know enough to be a good conversationalist for her husband, a good educator for her children, and a good manager for her home. All in all, Meiji reforms were a bit of a mixed bag for women. On the one hand, they included a radical overhaul of the education system, including for girls and women. Being a good wife and wise mother required an education the state provided, no less. And if a woman is capable of an education, she can't be so silly after all. On the other hand, the ultimate goal of this new education for girls was still a pretty limited one, to help women as wives and mothers for their husbands and sons. And ryōsai kenbō wasn't the only limitation on women. For example, married women became, quote, persons of legal incapacity under the Meiji Civil Code. That's the reformed system of laws that went into place during the Meiji period that started after 1868. That means they weren't legally competent to make their own decisions about their property or, for the most part, about their own persons. And the almost always male heads of their households had almost absolute authority over them. Quick side note, men weren't absolutely always the heads of their households. Writer Ichio Higuchi, for example, was actually the head of her household after her father died. Again, lest Americans or Europeans begin to feel self-righteous, in many U.S. states, women didn't have any property rights after they married until well after the Meiji Restoration. After the end of the Meiji period, there wasn't much movement on women's position in society for almost another 5 decades. When the Pacific War ended, the U.S. occupation forced the Japanese government to accept a new constitution. It granted a variety of fundamental human rights, including all the civil rights and civil liberties of the American Bill of Rights, but it went way beyond what Americans or people almost anywhere else are guaranteed under their constitutions. For today's purposes, I want to call attention to the fact it gave women explicit guarantees of equality in marriage, divorce, property, inheritance, and, quote, other matters pertaining to marriage and the family. Despite these guarantees on paper, though, Japanese activists continued to fight for years to see actual cultural and policy change. Japanese women in the 50s found themselves typecast even more aggressively as housewives. The government and culture still tried to force women into ryōsai kenbō. They just changed the goal. Instead of military success and imperial glory, good wives and wise mothers would benefit Japan's economic miracle. Men would go to work, earn the money, support the economy. Women would raise the children. That expectation still colors the way some Japanese parents raise their daughters. In the way universities admit students, there was a big scandal about med school just a few years ago. In the way companies hire, that's unconstitutional, but it happens anyway. In the way parties support candidates for election. The sort of expectations that women should stay home and men should make the money are more sexist than misogynist, and they still play an outsized role even in contemporary Japan. If you're interested in sexism in contemporary Japan, you might want to take a listen to last year's Valentine's Day episode, Sexlessness in Japanese Fiction. I will note that the World Economic Forum prepares a ranking every year of the Global Gender Gap Index. It compares countries' gender gaps based on economic opportunities, education, health, and political leadership. In 2022, the rankings I cite in last year's Valentine's Day episode, it ranked Japan 116th. In 2023, it dropped to 125th. For comparison, Germany ranked 6th, the UK ranked 15th, and the US dropped from 27th to 43rd. I should at least give Japan credit where credit's due. Japan handily beats Germany, the UK, and the US on relative educational attainment, which is a valuable accomplishment. But today, we're interested in misogyny. And there is certainly visible misogyny at the centers of Japanese political life. We've talked a good deal about Mieko Kawakami. She's a writer with a strong feminist bent. She has claimed, quote, "If things are going to change in Japan, we need that generation of chauvinist politicians, all with vested interests, to retire collectively." To back her up, I offer several notorious gaffes by Japanese politicians in the last two decades that more or less amount to saying the quiet misogynist part out loud. In 2007, then 71-year-old Health Minister Hakuo Yanagisawa made a speech about the nation's birth rate in which he bemoaned the fact, quote, "The number of women aged 15 to 50 is fixed because the number of child-bearing machines and devices is fixed. All we can ask for is for them to do their best per head." He then attempted to backpedal, although it may not be so appropriate to call them machines. In 2013, one reporter challenged the head of the Japan Family Planning Association. Why did a recent report published by the association have so much more data about men than women? "Sexual drive comes from males," he responded. "Females do not experience the same levels of desire." In 2021, Japan's ruling Liberal Democratic Party suggested that 5 female lawmakers could observe its overwhelmingly male board meetings. For listeners not familiar with Japanese politics, the LDP is actually a conservative party, and it has controlled Japan more or less continuously since World War II. The 82-year-old LDP secretary, Toshihiro Nikai, told the press it was important for women to, quote, "fully understand what kind of discussions were happening and to take a look." They wouldn't be allowed to talk, only submit opinions afterward. These remarks were quite poorly received on the heels of remarks that forced the then 83-year-old head of the Tokyo Olympics Organizing Committee to resign. Yoshihiro Mori was not only the head of the Tokyo Olympics Organizing Committee, he was also a former prime minister. The Organizing Committee was considering increasing the number of female board members. Of 24 members, only 5 were women. Mori's response was, quote, "If we increase the number of female board members, we have to make sure their speaking time is restricted somewhat. They have difficulty finishing, which is annoying. We have about 7 women at the organizing committee, but everyone understands their place." Before resigning, he tried to brush off the remarks with that classic defense, "My wife and daughters have already nagged me about it." And in 2023, Japan's then Minister for Gender Equality and his team wore vests to simulate pregnant bellies and breasts in support of women. I'm not naming the minister because I think this gaffes on the still-sitting Japanese Prime Minister, now 66-year-old Fumio Kishida. The men had to wear the vests because the committee members supporting women's equality were all men. I could go on with more examples. I'm not going to. To be completely fair, one of the worst offenders is actually a woman, 56-year-old Mio Sugita, who won a vote by the organization No to All Sexist Public Speeches, The group held a 2021 annual award for Most Sexist Comment. Her award-winning remark was to fellow party members at a briefing about support for victims of sexual assault. Her remark was, "Women can lie as much as they like." To summarize, Japan is a country, like many countries, including mine, with a complicated record on women's rights and attitudes about women. There's ample evidence that these attitudes are alive and well in some circles of Japanese political life. In the next section, I want to turn to how misogynistic attitudes about women are a part of the story of modern Japanese literature. Misogyny in Japanese literature is something of a twofold phenomenon, or at least something we can kind of approach from two angles. There's misogyny within the literary establishment that has affected women writers. In the past, it has kept them out of the industry by either simple sexism or misogynistic attitudes. Today, it still affects the way their work is received at home and abroad. And there are examples of misogyny in the work of Japanese writers, writers of all genders, but especially men. And as you'll see, misogyny often appears in the work of Japan's best beloved writers. We've covered the effects of sexism and misogyny on women's writers a good bit in episodes on the women writers of Meiji Japan in season 1 and translating Japanese women in season 2. Longtime listeners will have heard my rant about the representation of Japanese women in English translations more than once. Instead of revisiting those issues now, I'm going to very briefly review a piece of evidence that sexism and misogyny are alive and well in Japanese literary circles, whether it's intentional or not. I'm going to describe the literary establishment's response to Mieko Kawakami and her Akutagawa win in 2008. Mieko Kawakami won what is almost certainly Japan's most coveted literary award, again in 2008, but just listen to how the Japanese and English language press covered her victory. Former Akutagawa winner Shintaro Ishihara was on the Akutagawa committee when Mieko Kawakami won. He commented publicly about the prize-winning Breasts and Eggs that, quote, "the egocentric, self-absorbed rambling of the work is unpleasant and intolerable." I'll have more to say about Ishihara in a few minutes. A 2008 UK Independent article calls Kawakami a Bjork-loving 31-year-old. It goes on to quote a famous English-speaking critic, "Kawakami's popularity is part of the phenomenon of confessional fiction of the chick lit variety, where the writer is very frank about sex and personal, especially family, relationships." Perhaps that's not supposed to be dismissive, but chick lit? Come on. Honestly, even some of the press coverage a decade later, when the novel was adapted into a longer work and translated into English, was pretty insulting. Take the Japan Times headline, "Breasts and Eggs, Not Just Some Elevated Piece of Literary Chick Lit." Even a 2020 Tokyo Weekender article that's supposed to be about Kawakami's feminist viewpoint reminds us that, quote, "naturally, this style of writing doesn't appeal to everyone," and claims that Kawakami's novels tend to give her male characters short shrift. Completely untrue, by the way. One of her novels features a first-person narrator who is a very sympathetically portrayed male middle schooler. But for the rest of this section, we're going to look away from female writers to focus on misogyny in the work of Japanese male writers, especially some of the true geniuses best known in English translation. One more point of clarification: that writing misogynistic stories doesn't make someone a misogynist, and a misogynistic person doesn't necessarily write misogynistic stories. Historically, there has been a lot of overlap between authors' problematic attitudes on the page and in their lives. But there are many reasons a writer might represent misogynistic viewpoints without holding them him or her or themself. I'm going to do my best to differentiate misogynistic texts, stories that put forward a misogynistic viewpoint, from misogynistic authors, authors whose lives and words off the page demonstrate a contempt for women. If you're interested in learning more about the authors I'll be mentioning, we have entire episodes devoted to several of them, and you can find links on the episode page. Let me start with Meiji-era author Natsume Soseki. He is widely considered the father of modern Japanese literature. His 1914 novel Kokoro is often listed as one of his masterpieces and a favorite of readers in translation. The novel is framed as a student getting to know an older man whom he calls Sensei. It's pretty clear that the reader is also supposed to have some admiration for Sensei, but Sensei conveys shockingly misogynistic thoughts about women, especially later in the novel. He writes to the student that he would try to find comfort in the thought that Oku-san, the widowed mother of the girl he loved, behaved as she did because she was a woman. And women, after all, were idiots. Sensei goes on to note his contempt for women. Women giggle. Women graduate from university without having learned a thing. When Sensei remembers that he is too afraid to ask the woman he loved to marry him, he says, quote, "I thought that Japanese people, especially Japanese women, lacked the courage to be bluntly truthful on such occasions." When it comes to misogyny in literature, Osamu Dazai is a much more notable offender. His career peaked in the 1930s and 40s, but he's still one of the most popular Japanese writers in English today. He's had at least one new translation or reissued work released every year for the past several years. Again, he's been dead for more than half a century. And Dazai has even been trending on TikTok. In fact, part of my inspiration for this episode is that I think it's really important to recognize who we celebrate and why. Dazai is a genius, and the feelings of isolation he writes about really do speak to the present moment. But that doesn't make the attitudes about women on the pages of his novel any less problematic. Here's an example from Donald Keene's translation of No Longer Human that I used in an earlier episode. And it's worth noting that No Longer Human is a semi-autobiographical iNovel. It strongly overlaps with the narrative of Dazai's own life. The narrator notes, "I have often felt that I would find it more complicated, troublesome, and unpleasant to ascertain the feelings by which a woman lives than to plumb the innermost thoughts of an earthworm. Long personal experience has taught me that when a woman suddenly bursts into hysterics, the way to restore her spirits is to give her something sweet." Personally, I found the story Villon's Wife, republished in the collection Early Light, even worse. This one is told from a woman's perspective, supposedly. This time, the wife of a Dazai stand-in is front and center. The Dazai stand-in has all but abandoned her and their malnourished four-year-old. The wife must eventually take a job at a bar to pay for her husband's drinking debts. The narrative heavily implies this is a positive turn of events for everyone involved. "Why has such a good plan never occurred to me before?" she asks herself. "All the suffering I have gone through has been because of my own stupidity." Later, she doesn't argue when the Dazai stand-in tells her women don't know anything about happiness or unhappiness, and men only have unhappiness. Now, the decade after Dazai is a fascinating decade for writing about women in Japan. I'm going to be borrowing from the work of Dr. Julia Bullock at Emory University in her book, The Other Women's Lib. You can actually read The Other Women's Lib for free via open access. There's a link on the website. According to Bullock, post-war male writers sometimes used female characters to symbolize the fate of the Japanese nation. If they wrote about women's bodies being abused, it was a way to express the way men felt about defeat and occupation. Women, after all, are the sex that is supposed to be physically vulnerable, easily violated, susceptible to the temptation of giving in easily. You can see how this allegorical approach has misogynistic assumptions built in, and how the use of these metaphors, writing stories with weak female characters being overpowered by men, is misogynistic too. Even a decade later, in the 1960s, male writers were still writing the same kinds of stories. Male characters needed to reassert the masculinity they lost with the war and occupation by dominating female ones, often violently. The situation was probably complicated by the new rights granted to women under the 1945 Japanese Constitution that we discussed a few minutes ago. These newly granted rights quite probably seemed threatening to many men. I'd have to do way more research to fully support this claim, but I think we can infer that at least some men in the literary establishment felt threatened. The 1950s are the only decade in which not a single woman won the Akutagawa Prize. And that includes the 1930s and 40s. People familiar with his reputation as one of Japan's great leftist writers may be shocked to know that Kenzaburo Oe is guilty of this misogyny through allegory. Margaret Hildebrand at Oxford University isn't the only scholar to notice misogyny in Oe, but she helpfully pulls out five early career occupation narratives by Oe to demonstrate. I don't believe any are available in English translation. But in each, a young Japanese male, usually an intellectual, is caught up in a love affair between an older Japanese prostitute and her foreign patron or patrons. And those patrons are usually American. Oe published all five of these stories in pretty quick succession between 1958 and 1959. As Oe progresses from story to story, the prostitute becomes a little bit more sinister. The story seems a little less allegorical, a little less anti-US, and a little more anti-prostitute, or even just anti-women. By the fifth story, the only novel, the prostitute has gone from just being kind of tired to pretty gross. Malodorous breath, flabby form, poisonous genitalia. In the third and fifth stories by print date, the male protagonists can't get it up anymore, and they blame their impotence on the woman. I'm not sure I've ever seen that particular narrative trope used in a story that wasn't misogynistic. For my own part, I noticed and was bothered by a scene in Nip the Buds, Shoot the Kids, a book we discussed in an earlier episode. The middle third of the book portrays what is more or less a pastoral ideal society of kids, almost all boys, left alone without adults. Nevertheless, there's a scene of the boy narrator having questionably consensual sex with the young girl he's in love with. The reader doesn't get any sense, though, that something has happened that shouldn't have. Nip the Buds was published in Japanese at about the same time as the stories Hildebrand addresses. Nip the Buds is available in English, translated by Paul St. John McIntosh and Maki Sugiyama. Now, to be completely fair to Oe, his misogynistic writing is mostly early in his career. Some feminist critics have praised what Hildebrand calls the earthly and empowered representations of women that recur across his fiction. And Oe was a vocal champion of the rights of comfort women. Comfort women are women that Japan compelled into prostitution during and shortly after World War II. It's been a highly contentious issue in Japan really for about the last 70 years. Shintaro Ishihara is a writer of the 1950s who doesn't really have allegorical language as an excuse. He is perhaps one of the very worst offenders. And that's because he went on to become a politician, and we know that the assumptions he made about women applied not only on the page, but off of it as well. We mentioned his sexist comments about Miyako Kawakami earlier in the episode. Other comments about women include one made in 2001 to a women's magazine that, quote, "Old women who live after they have lost their reproductive function are useless and are committing a sin." Ishihara won the Akutagawa for Taiyo no Kisetsu, translated as Season of Violence, but more literally Season of the Sun, in 1956. The story is about a decadent young man who gets a girl pregnant. He can't decide if being known as a father will make him look more or less masculine. While he dithers, she decides to have an abortion, a dangerous procedure now that she's waited 4 months. It kills her. Of course, the story is more complicated than that, worth a read for its historical importance, but it's full of the young man's misogynist attitudes. Gems like, quote, "His friends only thought of their women as things as time went on, and this nursed the overly indulgent nature of their mother's love. One mother's son found out about his mother's affair and kicked her in the face. His friends heard of this and treated him with the greatest respect." One character, quote, "acquires girls just as a woman would add a dress of the latest style to her wardrobe." Like the double-layered problem there? He and his friends regarded women as indispensable accessories. We don't have many widely translated authors from Japan from the 1970s and 80s. Kobo Abe is the big exception. There are certainly examples of highly objectionable things happening to women in his work, but I can't think of any well-noted examples of outright misogyny. I did spend some time searching the internet and academic databases. I've only read a fraction of Abe's work myself. I'm very happy to post corrections. In the 1990s and 2000s, the main voice in Japanese translation was, of course, Haruki Murakami. Murakami, as you may be aware, has been challenged on his depictions of women. The challenges have gotten louder as Murakami has aged, especially because the women in his stories haven't. The narrator protagonist of 1995's The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle has a teenage confidant who shares information with him. Pretty personal information. Murakami would have been about 46 years old when that one was published. More than 20 years later, the narrator protagonist of 2017's Killing Commendatore paints a portrait of a teenager. Murakami would have been 68 years old. While she's posing, she reflects to him, "My breasts are really small, don't you think? They're like bread that didn't rise." When asked about this moment in the novel, Murakami responded that the narrator is, quote, "the sort of person who a 12-year-old girl would feel comfortable talking to about her breasts. He has that sort of personality." You can learn more about critiques of Murakami's women in our episode about Haruki Murakami. As I said in that episode, though, I agree that there are absolutely problems with the way Murakami portrays women, but I also think he maybe gets an exaggeratedly bad rap, in part because he's so widely read in translation. There are many examples of sympathetically portrayed women in his work, some exceptionally strong women in his work, and he isn't known as a sexist or a misogynist in his personal life. He's been very supportive of Miyako Kawakami's career, even when she's publicly criticized him. He's also readily credited his wife for her influence on his work. And I hope after today you can see that there are much worse offenders among the darlings of the Japanese literary establishment, among whom Murakami isn't really included. I want to bring up just one more example of problematic attitudes about women in more recent Japanese fiction, This one probably doesn't rise to the level of outright misogyny, but it's definitely entrenched sexism. Toshikazu Kawaguchi's perennially popular Before the Coffee Gets Cold, translated into English by Jeffrey Trusselot. Full disclosure, I can only discuss the first book in the series because it bothered me so much I haven't read any of the others. Before the Coffee Gets Cold is a problem because the women in the story are made happy only when they conform with traditional gender norms. Obey your parents, get married, sacrifice yourself. One character decides to wait on her sort of okay boyfriend to return from a job abroad. It'll make her parents happy if she gets married. Another gets guilted into continuing to act as a wife for her husband after he loses his memory to dementia, not just as a nurse, which she was willingly doing. Another free-spirited 24-year-old woman finds happiness by giving up her independent lifestyle to fulfill her family's expectations. She takes over the traditional family inn. The last woman, a diabetic, dies giving birth to her daughter, knowing in advance that this is going to happen. I mean, yeah, any of these choices might make a woman happy, but taken as a whole, this is a pretty clear throwback to the 1950s version of Good Wife, Wise Mother. Now, this is not a hopeless account. There is so much Japanese literature available that does not have sexist or misogynistic undertones. Many of Japan's women writers today are popular, at least in part, because their work challenges misogyny and sexism. Sayaka Murata's Convenience Store Woman, translated by Jenny Topley Takamori, and Emi Yagi's Diary of a Void, translated by Lucy North and David Boyd, are pretty aggressive statements against misogyny and or sexism. And there are plenty of male writers whose writing doesn't reflect misogynistic attitudes. Off the top of my head, I can't think of any examples of misogyny in the translated work of Hideo Furukawa, Shun Maideruma, Tomihiko Morimi. And let me mention one book that was translated in the last year that's another powerful statement against misogyny and sexism, written by a man, Ao Omae. It's People Who Talk to Stuffed Animals Are Nice, translated by Emily Balestrieri. Omae, again, is a male author, and the protagonist of the title story spends a lot of time thinking about the misogynistic or sexist viewpoints held by the other college students who spend time around him. When you think these ways, the narrator concludes, you end up conscious of turning people and being turned into something consumable. The whole collection of stories is marvelously anti-sexist and anti-misogynist. Highly recommended. That's it for part one. Join us for part two, a biography of Yukio Mishima, including content from Confessions of a Mask. We'll take a look at Mishima's biography through today's lens, misogyny in Mishima's writing, especially in the novels A Thirst for Love, Forbidden Colors, Beautiful Star, Life for Sale, and his short story Patriotism. I've read from several novels today. You can find titles and translators on the episode page. Remember that you can also support the podcast by buying your books from our bookshop.org shop, by leaving a review on your podcast app of choice, or by joining our Patreon for as little as $3 a month, patreon.com/readjapaneseliterature. We'd love to hear from you about the podcast. There are so many ways to stay in touch. Through the website, bluesky@readjapaneselit.bsky.social, Instagram, also @readjapaneselit, YouTube/@readjapaneseliterature. I'm not posting much content on Twitter, but you can find new episode updates there too, @readjapaneselit. Thank you to the Japanese Literature Groups on Goodreads and Facebook, and to the Japanese Literature Communities on Blue Sky and Twitter. And thank you, as always, to producer Kaim for today's music, KaimMusic.com. At the beginning of the episode, I promised to tell you a little bit more about the Matsuzawa Urushi Workshops project. Here's their statement. Japanese urushi has a history of 9,000 years, using the sap collected from natural urushi trees as a raw material. Urushi is used in a wide range of fields, such as temple and shrine architecture, Buddhist statues, urushi ware, decorative items, and art. It continues to have a significant impact on Japanese culture today. On January 1, 2024, the Noto Peninsula, home to Wajima City, in urushi craftsmanship, was struck by a devastating earthquake. Workshops, homes, equipment, and tools were lost. Some artisans died. The urushi industry is based on a long accumulation of expertise, so this disaster is a severe blow. As a result, Matsuzawa Urushi Workshop in Iwate Prefecture is calling for donations to support them. The workshop is also selling Phoenix fountain pens for the reconstruction of Wajima. Many things were lost due to the earthquake, but without long-term public and private cooperation, the unique, regional urushi culture may disappear. Again, you can find out how to help at tinyurl.com/urushirecovery. URUSHI recovery. tinyurl.com/urushirecovery. There's also a link on the episode page. Read Japanese Literature is promoting the project solely as a gesture of support.